This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, September 26, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. We now know some new details in the form of government documents about how the feds have used secret surveillance to spy on reporters. Julian Sanchez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. We discussed the newly released documents and what they mean. What do we know, or what have we known, about the degree to which reporters have been spied on by the U.S. government, and some of the rationales and product of that?
So possibly the most common rationale for spying on reporters, and I'm using that to include not just wiretap-style surveillance, but also the acquisition of email and phone records that reveal who people are talking to and how frequently, is in connection with leak investigations, at least that we know of publicly. Maybe the most recent controversial instance of this was the New York Times reporter Ali Watkins had years' worth of her email metadata, her email records and phone records seized, going essentially back to her college years, as part of a leak investigation targeting a congressional staffer that she had been romantically involved with. There were, during the Obama era, of course, a number of pretty high-profile controversies about government monitoring of press conduct. There was an incident where some months of telephone records on, I think, quite a number of different lines at the Associated Press were subpoenaed as part of a leak investigation. That was a controversial and significant part because they were really trying to focus on one or two reporters and one potential leaker, but also potentially gathered information that would reveal the news gathering activities of the organization as a whole, many other reporters. There was, of course, a notorious case where a Fox reporter was effectively named as a potential co-conspirator in essentially an act of espionage for doing the ordinary journalistic work of trying to cultivate sources. And this was done, I think, not actually because they intended to charge him, but because legally the law sort of required them to accuse the journalist of something as a precondition for getting a warrant to look through his communications. And in response to some of the controversies around this that occurred during the Obama administration, there was some tightening of the rules for when reporters' information could be subpoenaed or obtained under other authorities. But there were a number of gaps in that. We knew, again, sort of traditional kind of court orders and traditional authorities had a series of some stricter limitations put in place. There was a sort of committee established to advise on requests concerning members of the media, and a number of guidelines, including things like essentially you should exhaust other options and to demonstrate that this is sort of a last resort, that records of that kind should be obtained with the cooperation of the media entity targeted whenever possible. Usually there are ways to do this. When the reporter themselves is not the target, usually there are ways to do this that with the participation of their lawyers.
Now, Trevor Timm at the Freedom of the Press Foundation, following on a Freedom of Information Act request brought by the Freedom of the Press Foundation and Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, gives us at least a peek into the rules that the federal government has used for FISA warrants that relate to journalists. So what do we know now?
Well, so some of this is heartening. It is the guidelines for FISA surveillance are not as stringent as the ones we know apply to conventional criminal authorities. We don't see, for example, the requirement that other avenues be exhausted or there be some showing that the surveillance is necessary to some investigation or prosecution. There's not the same requirement that information be obtained with the cooperation of the media when possible. That arguably makes some sense in the context of intelligence and foreign intelligence where prosecution is not usually the goal. Whether something is essential is harder to determine. And we also do see that it's fairly broad. There is a requirement just for high-level approval by the Attorney General or the head of the National Security Division at the Department of Justice. And if a target of surveillance is determined to be a member of the media after surveillance commences, the Attorney General or one of his high-level designees has to be notified promptly. So this at least ensures that there's a higher level of review for cases where members of the press are swept in. And significantly, this applies sort of across the panoply of FISA authorities, including it doesn't apply to every kind of FISA authority. One of the conspicuous omissions is Section 702, where essentially NSA analysts designate foreigners outside the U.S. To be tasked for collection of their communications. So in those cases, there's no requirement for approval. But under other FISA authorities, including the physical search and pen register, which is, again, communications metadata, and business records authorities, as well as some of the other authorities for targeting Americans outside the U.S., this same high level of approval is required. Again, there are some of the omissions that do leave some cause for concern. Most major kind of global news operations have stringers operating around the world. So if you have New York Times reporters who are not citizens of the United States but are in, obviously, regular communication with their editors and their colleagues in the United States, this doesn't require that kind of approval for those people to be targeted under Section 702. Again, this is the discretionary authority under a broad umbrella court order for analysts to make the determination about who should be targeted. And we still don't know about national security letters. And that gap is in a way the most concerning because national security letters don't require judicial approval, can be issued by the special agent in charge of any of the FBI's 56 field offices, and cover precisely the kind of information that has been the source of controversy in the past. That is to say, phone records that would show a reporter's calling patterns, email records that would show their sort of digital communications patterns, and really, I think, give you a pretty effective roadmap to what a reporter is working on and who their sources are.
Now, to the extent national security letters have been used in the past, it's worth emphasizing again to an audience that may not be familiar with exactly what those are. They essentially prohibit you from saying anything about the fact that you're handing this data over to the government.
Right. Like most FISA authorities, NSLs are a slightly different section of the U.S. code, but come with gag orders. So in effect, when you receive one of these, you are not just forbidden from notifying the target, but you're effectively permanently barred from ever disclosing that you have even received such a letter. The courts did eventually say, okay, you can tell your own lawyer if you would like to challenge some aspect of the order you've received. But otherwise, you are effectively gagged indefinitely about saying anything about what you've received. Yeah, and this is also significant because, you know, one of the very few cases where we know historically the court received an application to compel the production of business records under FISA Section 215 that was refused, we know from public reporting and inspectors general's reports that one of those cases involved members of the media, members of the press, and that this rare denial of that request under the fairly low standard that applies to these Section 215 orders, which is just that has to be relevant to an investigation, was on the grounds that they had concerns about its implications on First Amendment rights. There is a section of those statutes that says an order can't be granted if its basis is purely First Amendment protected speech. And so this is one of these rare cases where the government was turned down by the court and because they thought this had disturbing First Amendment implications. And we know that in that case, the FBI turned around and immediately got exactly the same information the court had said they were not entitled to using national security letter authorities, even though, of course, that authority has the same caveat that it can't be used to target solely sort of for the purpose of targeting protected speech. So there is pretty clear historical reason to think that when courts are reluctant to authorize monitoring of journalists, national security letters are the tool that the government turns to because they don't require judicial oversight. And that is the one real serious gap in our understanding of what the constraints are on obtaining data about journalists.
Julian Sanchez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. You can subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast on iTunes, Google Podcasts, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And you can follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.